Hi there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is the New Books in Science, Technology, and Society podcast. Welcome, and thanks very, very much for joining me today for a conversation about a book that I'm really, really excited to share with you. This is Benjamin Peters' new book, How Not to Network a Nation, The Uneasy History of the Soviet Internet. This came out with MIT Press in 2016. Now, this is a book that is, first of all, a great set of stories. Ben is a really fabulous storyteller, and this is something that makes reading the book really pleasurable. So as you'll hear it in the hour to come, there are saxophone-playing robots, there are fake countries with fake-stamped passports, there are like workaholic cyberneticists, there's all kinds of really fabulous stuff. He talks about computer chess in the Soviet era, and some really interesting stuff along those lines as well. So first and foremost, some great, great stories here. It's also a really interesting opening up of a case study, a very local case study, and that is the 20th century in attempt to invent kind of computer networks and an internet ultimately in the Soviet context, which is itself, I think, a really interesting case study. And it takes the failure seriously, and it takes the failure of this to happen as neither obvious nor inevitable. So what Ben does is he uses this case study to open up much larger questions about privacy, about the nature of networking, about the relationship between technology and politics, about what we think and how we think when we think about the Cold War and when we think with the Cold War. So this is to say, it's not only a great set of stories, so it's a really pleasurable book to read, but it's also a really interesting case study for anybody who wants to read about Soviet history or the history of internet projects. But it's a case study with much larger potential implications. And you'll hear about some of those implications in detail when you come to the end of the interview and we talk about the conclusion and how to move forward from here. So I am super grateful to Ben for making the time to talk with me. And I'm really grateful to you as ever for making the time to listen. So thanks for your support of the channel. I hope you have a chance to get your hands on the book and flip through and really get into all the stories that we didn't have a chance to talk about. And I hope you enjoy the conversation to come. I'm here today to talk with Benjamin Peters about his new book, How Not to Network a Nation. Welcome to the New Books in STS podcast, Ben, and thanks very much both for making a book that's really, really going to be interesting to talk about. I'm really looking forward to this, and also for making the time to talk with me about it today. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Starla. I'm delighted.
Of course. So, Ben, let's start with a question that is traditional for the channel, and that is, let's start by talking about how you came to the field. Now, early in the prologue, you talk about, in the book, how you came to an interest in Russia and in understanding Soviet infrastructure in particular. But for you right now, what would you want to share with listeners about what brought you to this particular field and this particular period of Russian history?
Awesome. Thanks. Yeah, I certainly had no intentions even 10 years ago to be writing the history that I, or the book that I wrote. And I think I grew up in a home that was, I had a home of a musician and of a professor. And I think I spent most of my childhood, I had a passing interest in Russian literature, but wasn't necessarily really keyed into the questions of media history or sociology or politics or technology that come up in the book. Instead, I really spent most of my time in a small Middle Eastern college town, Midwest college town, kind of marinating myself in music and mathematics. And I think that kind of, habit for technical abstraction, which is, where you're looking at the relationship between practice, both musical instruments and math, and also rigorous creativity and how those things come together, I think is still something like a distant engine that is still very much alive in my work, or even the cosmology of my work. There's abstractions that animate my interest in the Soviet networks and their interest in planning, as well as more generally in media theory and in history, that I think kind of owe a debt to my parents a long time ago. Fast forward a little bit, I had then a really lovely year-long honors course during my freshman year at college. And this was a course for non-science majors. It was like you effectively test it out of all the science credits that you need for general education, and the product took, and in the process took 9 credits with 3 professors who were like these old chummy friends, a physicist, a geologist, and a historian slash philosopher. And I mean, it just opened my eyes. I had been interested in history and the humanities and science before college, but I never knew that one could bring the two together. And so this sort of early introduction to history of and philosophy of science and technology, I think, really still stands out as a bright moment in my early upper education. And then, in the book, I point to another moment, one of 2 sort of formative moments behind the project in particular. In 2001, I was a 20-year-old, and I was serving in a small town in Balakova doing service volunteer work. And Balakova is in the Volga Russia region in the post-industrial Rust Belt. I just remember this one moment as I was standing on the edge of the Volga River looking over this giant reservoir, and it was this picturesque, beautiful spring evening with the sun setting and the rolling green hills and the forest all about me. And I also was struck by that scenic, the picture, by the outsized industrial might that somebody 60 years ago had planned into Balakova, this very small town. You know, you could see within that view 4 nuclear power plants, a huge hydroelectric dam or station that just stretched like a kilometer across the water, decaying military industrial factories, this contrast sort of struck me. What's motivating this planning imagination? Who thought that Balakova, of all the sort of scenic middle of nowhere towns in the world, coming from Iowa, this is maybe also autobiographical, would also be a good place to house such to be an energy center for that whole part of Russia. And so I think that was like another sort of crystallization of my interest in planning and long-term projections and the rest of it. Let's see. Fast forward a little bit more. And during my master's, I was fortunate enough to be able to take a graduate seminar from Fred Turner in 2005 at Stanford, where he was teaching a course on the ideologicalization of the American computer in the Cold War. And, something clicked for me there because this was the year before his important book From Counterculture to Cyberculture came out. And I was just struck, like, oh my gosh, he has such an extraordinary story. How do I not know this, first of all? And also, how can I tell the global side of this? So this is a Cold War story, and yet the Soviet picture is missing. Clearly, as a Russian specialist, I might be able to contribute to that. So, I mean, I think that's the prelude. And, one other thing that brought me particularly to this Soviet internet history, and which is half of my dissertation at Columbia, was also just a turn to media studies, which I have to admit came a little bit late in my life. I didn't really know I was interested in STS and media and the rest of it until I was done with my master's and was fishing around looking for a job and a way to go forward. And I realized I was qualified for all sorts of dubious jobs that involved suits, shades, and sidearms, and with my master's in Russian studies. And I was like, oh, this is not what I'm looking for. And then honestly, it was kind of a desperation moment. I just reflected and realized that my dad, John Durham Peters, had a really wonderful job. And I was like, as a 24-year-old, I was like, oh, yeah, right. What does dad do?
I actually interviewed him about The Marvelous Clouds.
So, oh, fantastic.
Yeah, so listeners can do like a Peters the Older and Peters the Younger doubleheader if they want.
There you go. There you go.
But I'm sorry, go on.
No, that's great. So, I mean, if you, those who don't know my dad, I think he's really a lovely person. I really, really admire him. And I appreciate the intellectual generosity in his work. And I guess I just realized, man, he has a good thing going. What does he do? And so I tried it out, and media studies fit and felt really good. And I think to this day, much of my training in it is really more filial than formal, if that makes any sense. So maybe that's like the prehistory. And then the one moment where the book kind of clicked into being, when the question, I could actually express it. I remember quite clearly sitting over my desk on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, rereading a biography of Norbert Wiener, who's the founder of cybernetics I was reading it in 2007, fishing for a dissertation project, when I read in the footnotes that there is a CIA Russian specialist report that had been subsequently declassified, in which they were wringing their hands about the possibility of the Soviets developing in 1962, quote, a unified information net. And then I was like, oh my gosh, of course. Of course the Soviets were trying to develop a unified information net. This makes perfect sense. They're deep cyberneticists at the time, and you know the ARPANET is developing at the time. This is the height of this tech race. Where in the world is this story? How do I not know this? And that sort of threw me headlong into what eventually became the book, How Not to Network a Nation.
Awesome. And I will say thank you for making my job so easy. You should like have your own podcast, man.
Oh, this is
awesome. No, this is great. Okay, so I want to thank you so much for already going into how you came to the project, and that's great. You mentioned something I'd like to ask you to talk just a little bit about if you're interested, and that is the fact that this was something that began its life not as a dissertation, right? Even though this is the first monograph, but as part of a dissertation that you did at Columbia. So because I know I and many of our listeners are particularly interested in that transformation, right? How do you go from a kind of the raw material of, in this case, just part of, right, a dissertation into a manuscript? Can you talk about that transformation a little bit for us? Yeah, like for you, what was important along the way of that transformation and metamorphosis from like part to whole?
Absolutely. I mean, this may be a bit too confessional, but I that's an absolutely fantastic question. And we're all concerned, particularly my peer group, like, how do we make this work regularly? I really don't think there's any magic or any particular principles that hold. In my case, I've blessed them all. My committee were just probably too generous in letting my dissertation be ungainly Frankenstein. It had maybe two, maybe three book projects sort of squished in there together, and none of them really cohering as their own standalone project. So I feel like the fact that I was able to move to separate projects was a happy accident from the fact that I had tried to pack too much in during the dissertation project itself, and was just trying to do too much, and thus maybe not enough at all. But maybe then again, I can say with blithe retrospect, the kind of point of dissertations is they're supposed to be done. And they're supposed to contain the seeds for carrying forward qualified work that will contribute to the field. I sort of chose the Soviet internet story quite candidly as my first book project, where I could have done a couple others, simply because I think it had the most obvious story. And kind of there's this narrative weight to, at least for some readers, some may not feel the attraction at all, but just realizing that the Soviets were working on something while we were developing the internet has this sort of obvious narrative appeal, I think. And I just wanted to tell that story. I can talk later maybe about some of my future projects, but I think they need a little more time. And in the end, maybe that's what scholarship is about, is figuring out how to find the institutional and intellectual conditions to be able to really marinate and take your time to get somewhere. I think my next projects are going to take a little bit more time than this one.
Oh, yeah. And that's a whole other conversation. I can't tell you how many times lately and not so lately I'll talk with someone about the really kind of dramatic differences between the first book and the second, right? Yep. So I think it's important to think in those terms, right, of giving ourselves the time and the space to really to take that on in a very different way from a first book manuscript.
That's right.
Yeah. So let's dive right in. What I'm going to do is kind of set the stage a little bit and then ask you to talk about some of the things that you brought up very early in the book. Okay, so the book's central premise, for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to become readers, is that there was once, in the words of the book, something that we might think of as the Soviet internet, and its failure was neither natural nor inevitable. You bring us into some motivating questions. First question, why did Soviet networks, and we'll talk about some of them, I think the one major one that the book develops, and we'll talk about this in a little bit, is the All-State Automated System, or OGAS, OGAS. Why did that not take root? What obstacles did network entrepreneurs face? And we can talk perhaps about that notion. How might we begin to rethink our current network world in light of Soviet experience? Okay. Now, the book argues that, again, in the words of the book, the primary reason that the Soviets struggled to network their nation rests on the institutional conditions supporting the scientific knowledge base and a command economy. And the book develops a central proposition along these lines. Although American ARPANET initially took shape thanks to, again, in the words of the book, well-managed state subsidies and collaborative research environments, the comparable Soviet network projects stumbled, and this was due to widespread, unregulated competition among self-interested institutions, bureaucrats, and other key actors. The first global civilian computer networks developed, as you put it here, and this is a key phrase, so I'm going to just kind of flag this for listeners. They developed among cooperative capitalists, not among competitive socialists. Okay, so I wanted to just get that out there because this is a trope that comes up over and over again in the book, right? This idea that these networks developed among cooperative capitalists and not competitive socialists. Now, what I'd like to ask you to talk a little bit about is a kind of corollary that comes out of this. And you mentioned this very early in the book. Along these lines, you say that it's a mistake to project Cold War biases into this story. Okay, so let's maybe start there. For you, what are some of the ways that kind of Cold War historiography might kind of misshape or kind of give us an impression of what might be happening here that would be wrong and or that might be misleading? And how does the book, along the lines that I've just been describing, undo or help us kind of not fall into these Cold War historiographical traps?
That's a really great question. So let me range a little bit broadly to begin with before I come back to the book. I mean, I think if the book has something to contribute to broader sort of network and information society discourse, reflections on where we are today, my hope is that it will sort of be a gift for an alternative or an alternate imagination of a networked society, right? And I think that my underlying instinct somehow to reverse or deconstruct or otherwise critique Cold War network discourse really follows from something that we're experiencing today. And I don't mean this in any presentist terms, but I think it comes without much surprise that the last 20 or 30 years of reflection about the internet, much right enthusiasm no less, has sort of centered around the internet and computer networks as natively virtuous or capable agents for carrying out liberty and democracy, sort of deliberative democracy and commerce, right? And so if I could just flag those as towering Western values that are directly tied into what I see as kind of a techno-triumphalism that we get just by virtue of the fact that both the Cold War ended and the internet began in the popular imagination at more or less the same time. So those two things are wedded in our minds, rightly or wrongly, through historical accident. And what I'm offering, I hope, is an engaged, if not critical, kind of attempt to reread or make an icy reversal around another way of thinking about networks. And that is when you look at, and you know, just instead of liberty, democracy, and commerce, we might be thinking about the ways that the Soviets were designing networks and building networks with their own social values, kind of cybernetic collectivism, or something I'm thinking about now, or as a network that served a hierarchical state, and also a network that served a planned command economy. And none of those things resemble, at a glance at least, the dominant paradigmatic values that I think we inherit with our own network discourse. So another way of saying that is that this is a chance to rethink what social values, if any, must be associated with networks.
Mm-hmm. And you just mentioned the term command economy. Now, this is something that comes up as a focus, at least, of what's happening in Chapter 2. But and for the time being, very, very briefly, for listeners who might hear that phrase and think, command economy, what is that and why is that important? Can you very briefly just describe what that means for listeners?
Sure. So the command economy is famously the other to the free market, right? So instead of a market being governed, a free market economy being governed by local prices and property rights and free exchange, commerce, The planned economy is one where social justice and social economic justice goals are driven by quota and regulation and top-down planning, right? So that exchange and values are dictated rather than discovered, I think is kind of the classic distinction.
Awesome. And so bringing up this, the importance of the structure, right? You mentioned top-down. This actually really nicely brings us into some of the really interesting stuff that's happening in the first chapter. Now, the first chapter opens up with a story of the history of what you call the global consolidation and spread of cybernetics in the middle of the 20th century. So in addition to being a kind of quick and dirty, but I mean that in a good way, right?
Yeah,
like
yeah.
A quick and dirty thumbnail sketch of like what we need to know about the history of cybernetics with McCulloch and the Macy conferences and the idea of feedback and Wiener and all that sort of stuff to understand what's going to come next. You also bring us into really interesting and important ways that cybernetics was articulated very differently in different international settings. So there's material here on kind of how cybernetics was taken up and developed and transformed in England and France and Chile and Argentina. Now, importantly, in addition to this, the chapter does a work or a kind of work that's going to become, again, very, very important as we move forward, and that is the work of introducing another key concept. This is the concept of heterarchy. Now, heterarchy describes, in the words of the book, as you put it here, complex networks with multiple conflicting regimes of evaluation in operation at the same time. Now, for us, Ben, can you talk a little bit about how you think about the importance of this notion for the work that the book is doing at this point? What is heterarchy for you, and what's important for us to understand about this notion in order to understand the importance of heterarchy as it's going to play out specifically in the Soviet context?
Awesome. Great. Yeah, so heterarchy I see as an underused and potentially very valuable, too sexy way of saying something very simple, which is it's a way of describing organizational forms that have an order, but not an order that can be expressed linearly or very clearly or plainly. And so a heterarchical approach, which is this, again, this cybernetic term inherited from one of the founders of cybernetics, Warren McCulloch, in the American post-war consolidation of this cybernetic vocabulary, is becomes a useful term for me for thinking about the very organizational forms that are at stake in the internet and network discourse today, right? So if in a sort of cheap caricature of Silicon Valley, wired, blue chip wired, flatly organized, horizontally, horizontal flat startup companies, right? It presents a myth of an organizational structure. And then, of course, in opposition to that is the hierarchy, the top down sort of where every member in a hierarchy, every node knows both who its supervisor and its subordinates are. And there's a clear linear logic that describes your relationship to your neighbors. And so if those are the sort of the market and the planned economy poles, then what I think heterarchy allows us to do is to think with some more nuance about organizational forms that don't hold still and that exist in the complex world that, well, that cybernetics really inherits from the wake of World War II, as well as tries to describe in its system vocabulary. So that heterarchy, I hope, is a way for us to think about organizational forms where there's multiple competing logics and demands on any person, and every moment is continuously negotiated because of this complex, hard-to-describe organizational structure.
Great. Now, after a really interesting set of conversations in this first chapter about stuff that we're not going to have time to talk too much about, right?
Sure.
Including the ways that in international context, the mind or brain was treated as an analogy for thinking about national networks. And this plays out very differently and interestingly differently in different contexts. And addition to the way that cybernetics, or a description of the way that cybernetics in the Soviet Union in the 50s and 60s developed from a kind of stage of rejection to post-Stalinist rehabilitation to adoption to adaptation. And you talk about this move from kind of reactionary pseudoscience to a kind of mainstreaming, which is really interesting. We move into a chapter that really takes on this idea of heterarchy, right, and introduces the kind of the economy that we're talking about that forms a kind of groundwork and a foundation within which these plans for the Soviet internet were developed. So chapter two looks at the emergence of economic cybernetics in the late 50s and early 60s. Now, this field was closely related to mathematical economics and econometrics, but it had particular implications, right, for the politics here, for Soviet politics. And you introduce what you've already talked about, which is the command economy and the way that hierarchical structures kind of shape what's happening here. Now, the end of this chapter, and I know we're kind of speeding through, so feel free to back us up if you want to, but the end of this chapter makes a really important point that I want to ask you to talk a little bit about, because it'll, again, keep coming up for the rest of the book. What happened to the Soviet internet is, at least in part, at least insofar as my reading of this, right, reveals, but is at least in part a story about the separation between military and civilian sectors. Yeah. So this is where this starts developing. Can you talk a little bit about that? Like, again, for you, what's important or what's crucial for us to understand about the separation between military and civilian in this context? Because this, again, is going to become really important as the story unfolds.
Yeah, great. Thank you. So, I mean, I think if there's an uncomfortable lesson that I take from the fact that these that the Soviet economy was continuously stumbling over the fact that it was both the purse for the military as well as never the beneficiary of military technology. It is, this may be, I don't know if this is true, but let's just try it out. So if there is a virtue to the military-industrial academic complex in the West, it is the complex and the dashes that unite, that that permit cross-agency collaboration and knowledge exchange and technological adoption. And, you know, there's lots of things that I'm not comfortable in the slightest about in terms of the militarization of technology in the West. But that said, what was even less comfortable to me was watching again and again these sort of bold, socially ambitious, generally pro-social attempts to use technology to benefit many, many, many people in the world, in the Soviet context, continuously running up against not like structurally well-regulated, but just kind of pernicious and often dismissive attitudes from the military, right? The military just would not have anything to do with civilian concerns. And that ends up being a key, and divide is too clean, but a key chasm for describing the eventual unraveling of these overbold pro-social networks that I talk about later.
Awesome. And this is something that you take on in, I think, very beautiful and very evocative detail in Chapter 3. So Chapter 3 looks at the first three attempts to network the Soviet nation. Now, all of them failed, but all of them failed in really interesting ways, right? So these are all really, really interesting stories. In addition to, I'm going to work upward from the bottom because it'll get us back to this military-civilian relationship that becomes so interesting in the first place. So the third example you mentioned, and I'll just briefly mention it here, was N.I. Kovalev's proposal for a rational system for economic control using a nationwide web of computer networks. So that was really interesting. There's also a proposal in 1962 to build a kind of unified communication system. This is called the ESS in the book, that would standardize and consolidate all communication signals in the Soviet Union. Also failed. Now, the first example that you bring up, though, which was, again, also a failure, failed in ways that really reveal what you describe as this real difference between the way that the military and civilian sectors interacted or not in the Soviet case and the way that they interacted in the American case, which really reveals some kind of important distinctions that have reverberations, I think, for the story to come. So this first case was a 1959 proposal by Anatoly Kitov to build a nationwide computer network for for civilians on pre-existing military networks. Now, he was the first Soviet cyberneticist and was probably, as you put it here in the book, the first person, like full stop, right? The first person anywhere to propose a large-scale computer network for civilian use. So can you talk about him a little bit or introduce him for us? Kind of what was the big deal about what he was proposing, and who is this guy for listeners who may not have heard of him?
Sure. Anatoly Kitov is one of the major protagonists of the book. And as you've already beautifully described, he played a number of firsts. Although I am clear in the book, I hope to sort of shed doubt on the value of first claims, mm-hmm. in particularly in like the horse race that is Cold War tech. I'm interested nonetheless in what sort of motivated him. So he was the son of a Menshevik or a white army officer who had escaped to Tashkent. And he grew up a young mathematician and was thrown into World War II, where he excelled in ballistics like many, many others. Sort of later information theorists often had a relationship with ballistics curiously. And then, as you've already suggested, had an early career rise in the military, reclaiming and rehabilitating cybernetics as something that's not just the pseudo-bourgeois pseudoscience, but rather something that fit really well with the Soviet systems-oriented control approach. And Kitov, you know, I think sort of the brilliance of his proposal in the fall of 1959 is actually how undramatic it is. From his perspective, he was just taking the next little baby step in what seemed like a very obvious progression. So in the spring of 1959, there was already wide discussion about, hey, computers are like fancy calculators. We should use these locally unconnected to improve economic planning purposes. And this is a broad discussion that's of no profound revelation. And he's very much part of that. Later on in the fall, he makes what he sees as the next obvious step. Why don't we just connect those economically oriented high-speed calculating machines and allow them to talk to one another? And this is, you know, one of those moments like when Hannah Arendt describes Sputnik as like this little blipping metal ball that doesn't do anything except fall to the ground and yet simultaneously has, well, cataclysmic consequences for what it means to be in the human condition. I think so too. We might be able to see really dramatic consequences following from very small steps. So he begins this, hey, let's network our nation initiative that takes root later in other projects. But I think that for me, the significance of his story is actually how unsexy or undramatic these innovations can appear, or these inventions can appear in the very first moments.
Now, this case becomes really interesting for the larger set of arguments that the book is making for many reasons. But one of those reasons, as I very briefly indicated before, is that it helps us understand something interesting, I think, about the relationship between military and civilian sectors at this point. So you contrast this with the American case. In terms of computing, as the chapter here indicates, the biggest advantage the U.S. had over the USSR at this point was not necessarily the market independence of private commerce. And I mention that because, right, that's like an assumption that a lot of people might bring to this. Instead, it was about porousness. It was about the porousness of flows of research and resources and knowledge between military and civilian contexts. And those flows were much more readily enabled in the American context, and they were not in the Soviet context. And this is one of the big differences here that, again, had reverberations for what happened ultimately in terms of the history of networking in both cases and contexts.
I'm nodding vigorously. Let me just throw out a brief moment on the U.S. story. And of course, it's already, you know, in my attempt to try to deconstruct the Cold War story, I realize I'm in fact rehearsing a binary by pointing to the U.S. as an alternative. We could point to Chile or France or Britain or Germany or others outside that immediate West too. But just briefly to point to how the ARPA and the ARPANET worked institutionally, it's really kind of a surprise story. In many cases, the directors of the ARPA are telling Congress one thing. We need defense-oriented funding. We're going to solve your military problems. And then they would turn around and talk to the researchers about basic research questions. And here's some funding to go solve fundamental problems. And that is not a sort of a clean, easily virtuous story, but it's an important institutional story that I think is very distinct from the very strict lines drawn in the Soviet case. And just briefly to point to what happened to Kitov, I would just point out that after having proposed his first economic network, his military supervisors intercept his proposal, and then effectively put him on a show trial and dismiss him for having criticized the military computer technology and having tried to supersede their own managerial power. So that, you know, he was in fact dismissed from the Communist Party for a year, and it's kind of a sad story, but a very clear line was drawn in the sand there, where in the case of the ARPANET, you have porousness, yeah, in your phrase.
Well, that's your phrase.
Bumpy porousness.
Get total credit for that. So in addition to all of these points, this chapter also makes an important point, which is, I think, a major take-home lesson that I want to just flag here because it's going to come up again later. This is, again, in the words of the book, that there's no inherent connection between the designs of technological and political systems, right? This seems really important. Did you want to talk about that a little bit? Because it seems like that's a pretty major take-home here.
Absolutely. No, I mean, that's maybe the bigger, I should have put this up front, because when I was contrasting not liberty, not democracy, and not commerce as the driving values behind the Soviet network, what I really mean to say is that, you know, I think Latour once quipped that technology is society made durable. And it, you know, I think his point there is that technology embeds social values and we can see it last over a long time. But I want to flip that here and say that in the Soviet case, and maybe in STS and the history of media more generally, we can see that society is technology made temporary, in the sense that our values are temporary and they will pass. Our values and assumptions about technology will pass as our society shifts. And that seems like a really essential point to bear in mind when we're doing the tango that is trying to study the relationship between technology and society, or their mutual embeddedness. The healthy, I think, reminder of the Soviet case is these values were inherently obvious and as native and as clear and as straightforward and probably as functional as commerce or peer-to-peer participatory democracy might appear to the open source programmer today. And that means nothing about the long-term inheritance of the network in the end, at least philosophically. And so we need to be aware of that, I think.
Thank you so much. Now, as we move to the fourth chapter, we move to another really fascinating, this is one of my favorite characters in the whole book, or actors in the whole book, a really fascinating person. And this is Viktor Glushkov. So chapter four introduces the most ambitious of the Soviet network projects. And this is one that I briefly mentioned at the very beginning of our conversation. This is the All-State Automated System, or OGAS, OGAS. How do we
Perfect.
Do you?
Yep.
And this was promoted by this cyberneticist, Viktor Glushkov. So I just need to hit the ball back to you and ask you to introduce him, because he is fabulous. He's just such a fascinating figure. So who is Glushkov, and what's the nature of what he was proposing? Can you just kind of detail that for us?
Absolutely. So the OGAS is Viktor Glushkov's self-proclaimed life work. And he works on it publicly between 1962 and 1982, when he dies, tragically, of a brain hemorrhage. Glushkov is, as his New York Times obituary calls him, which is unusual, the king of Soviet cybernetics. And was a leading mathematician, algebraist, and cyberneticist in the period. And I think, you know, the OGAS full title really speaks for itself, and what Glushkov was after. So here's the train, and that is the full official title: the All-State Automated System for the Gathering and Processing of Information for the Accounting, Planning, and Governance of the National Economy, USSR.
A nice little ring to it, right? Super simple, a little catchy.
Very quippy. Put it on a bumper sticker.
That's right.
Well, we laugh, but I mean, it's also fundamental, that kind of bureaucratic culture, to modernity. And network projects are deeply indebted into our the our willingness to trust large scale institutions and to write out really long, to invest our life work into such projects. And I don't think in this that Glushkov is different from us. I think that he's very much a pioneer of network thinking that we would recognize as our own. So, just briefly to describe the contours of it, he imagined a decentralized hierarchical network that would also be used for planning and processing, managing in real time the command economy and all information flows relevant to the processing of the economy, which in a Soviet, remember, in a Marxist sense, is a very broad definition. We're not just talking about currency exchange. We're really have at the stake the base, the material base of modern society. So this bold, ambitious project had three tiers, so three layers, a central computer center in Moscow, 100 or 200 prominent regional city center computer centers, and then as many as 20,000 local regional computing centers that would be spread throughout the planned economy on the factory floors and enterprises. And effectively, this is the electronic nervous system for the economic body that is the command economy in his vision. And it would thus sort of make efficient and speed and increase the transmission speed for all this. But far more importantly for him, he also, as a theorist of decentralized power and a Marxist philosopher, effectively, at least of technology, he's thinking about transformations of information as well, and is definitely invested in a much more material sense of information than I think we usually take when we're talking about kilobytes sent in an email or in a text today. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, he's also an interesting thinker.
And he also proposes a kind of wireless currency, right? I mean, he's coming up with these ideas that seem very prescient given the society we live in right now, right? He's doing all kinds of interesting things.
Yeah, no, 1962 proposes e-currency effectively with no premonition, of course, of PayPal or Bitcoin or blockchain or the rest of it, but rather has squarely in mind a broad vision of Marxist prophecy that would virtualize, hard currency. And so he imagined an online system for exchanging receipts, and that with this would be enough that we might be able to get rid of the dirty stuff of money. Of course, I think his prudent advisors suggested that he separate that electronic currency proposal from his greater network proposal, and out of fear that the e-currency proposal would raise unhelpful anxieties among the state officials. And Glushkov did, and thanks to that sort of bureaucratic pragmatism, the e-currency proposal was shot down, but the network proposal survived for another day. If I could just point to a couple other things that I think he does that are surprising. And when I say he, I want to be clear, I'm not really talking about just Glushkov, but rather the school of scientists and researchers that are with him. He's the director of the Institute of Cybernetics in Kiev. So we're really talking about the collective labor and intellectual work of hundreds of people in Kiev in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. But they're discussing something very relevant today, a real-time remote access surveillance network. That's the OGAS. And without talking in misleading metaphors about cloud computing, they're just talking very explicitly about what a remote access network is for. It's for surveillance, meant to gather tens of thousands of dossiers about individuals and organizations in the Soviet context, which is extraordinarily relevant, I think, to how we fail to understand what cloud computing is doing today, which obscures both the enormous carbon footprint as well as the surveillance and privacy invasions that are baked into all remote access networks for the longest time. So I think there's something just really clarifying about how explicit they are in their discussions. They don't have IT admin telling them how to frame their computer technologies, and there's something refreshing about that.
Now, one of the other really interesting things that he's involved with is something that I think the universe, in making it the case that there's background music for us a little bit. I don't know if you've been hearing this a little bit in the background, but there's like music happening that I can at least hear, or at least there was a little while ago down in the city below me. This is, I think, the cosmos reminding me, talk about the saxophone playing robot mascot. Talk about the saxophone. And so to bow to the demands of the cosmos and ask you to talk a little bit about the saxophone playing robot mascot, which is, and you don't have to talk about that specifically, but this is part of the larger phenomenon of Cybertonia that unfolds at this Institute of Cybernetics. So I'm just going to throw that out there. Cybertonia, what gives?
The cosmos has spoken.
The cosmos has spoken. Exactly.
We've got to jump into this. So Cybertonia is the other side of the Soviet story, right? So the story I've been telling you so far is about Glushkov's formal bureaucratic, big scale, ambitious, ideologically faithful projects. And the other side is the informal practice, the like lived culture, the work environments in which many of these projects were taking shape in the 60s in particular. So Cybertonia is this lovely after-hours work club, effectively, at the Institute of Cybernetics that was christened in on New Year's Eve on 1960 at a New Year's party and kind of became an opportunity for organizing soirees, and conferences, and social events, but also research and rethinking the researchers' very relationship to the state. So during the daytime, presumably their official work would serve the purposes of building a state servant, a network, a computer network, and its related sub-projects. And then in the after hours, they would get together and coin their own imaginary country. So Cybertonia was a virtual country independent of Moscow's rule in their fanciful imagination. Papers were published on, quote, wanting to remain invisible, at least to the authorities. There was lots of merry pranksterism and pun-filled sort of civil disobedience where they're issuing faux passports, and even their own constitution and wedding certificates and newsletters and their currency on punch cards. And yeah, as you pointed out, they appointed as their supreme leader and mascot a saxophone-playing robot. A council of robots, in fact, governed Cybertonia, which is just, I think, a lovely. Now, you know, we now have the Fred Turner's classic countercultural story to the West has a breadth of comparative perspective in this moment in the 1960s in Kiev, right? So the Cybertonia is eventually squished under state pressure in 1968 and 69, but for a good short decade, they're having a great time.
Now, after we kind of explore Cybertonia for a little while, we come into the last body chapter of the book. And this is a body chapter that, again, looks closely at Ogas, but it looks closely at the undoing of Ogas between 1970 and 1989. Now, as you put it here, and this is in the words of the book, the project found itself stalemated in a morass of bureaucratic barriers, mutinous ministries, and institutional infighting among a state that imagined itself as centralized, but was actually anything but. So let's just open this up. Can you tell us about what you take to be some of the major factors in the undoing of Ogas? And for us, what is understanding these factors help us to understand more broadly about networking in the Soviet Union and perhaps beyond?
Yeah. Let's go back to heterarchy. So I think the big point about how the Ogas project did not come to be is a story of heterarchy. I think it is a commonplace to assume that the Soviet state was had troubles because it was too top-down and too rigid. And in many cases, of course, it was that. But in practice, it was also intensely and overwhelmingly heterarchical. Rather than a hierarchy, it's heterarchy. That is to say that in practice, the bureaucrats, the ministers, the factory managers, the factory workers, and even the economic reformers were, as is much the case today, in ways we might be able to think about today, in continuous, not open competition, but constrained competition. Their own institutions governed what could and could not be said, and what could or could not be brought to be. So let's take the Ogas as our specific case study of this larger sort of critique of the Soviet state. Perhaps the closest it ever came to finding full state funding was on October 1st, 1970, when after a series of stalemated reviews and eventual approvals, the proposal worked its way up Glushkov's proposal worked its way up to the Central Committee, the Politburo, the governing committee of the Soviet state. And they were gathered to decide thumbs up or thumbs down on this massive attempt to manage the command economy. And they did so, I might note, a little less than a year after the ARPANET goes online. And it's the political motivations are pretty clearly both that the Soviet Union, the Soviet state is trying to figure out how to better govern its faltering economy, and it's also trying to figure out how to respond adequately to an ongoing U.S. Cold War tech race. And the OGAS appears the next best step. So briefly, the meeting takes place in the Kremlin, and everything appears to be going great when the Minister of Finance stands up and says, no, look, this is too far, too much, too quick. We need to reassess and start much more simply. And in fact, the committee ends up agreeing with him that the OGAS is too ambitious. We should start just by building computers, a technical network base, which is a very pragmatic and I think reasonable suggestion, actually. But it turns out that's not the real motivation that brought about the demise of the OGAS. In fact, the Minister of Finance had previously approached the Prime Minister and said, look, if you guys support the OGAS, it's going to go to my competing minister, ministry in the Central Statistical Administration. And if those guys have control of this massive funding, they're going to squash me, but they're also going to keep you, Prime Minister, from being able to reform the economy, which was Alexei Kosygin's major goal. Furthermore, if you let OGAS go to get funded and stay under control of the CSA, the Central Statistical Administration, my ministry will do our all to submarine and sabotage the OGAS project internally, which was something that Garbuzov, the Minister of Finance, had actually done to Kosygin 5 years earlier with his Kosygin-Lieberman piecemeal liberalization reforms. So there was a precedent for this type of activity. And anyway, the point is that this kind of ministry mutiny is one key example of a larger sort of discontent in an institutional unwillingness to collaborate and to cooperate, to share power. And that I think, is the bigger story. And it's not a story told well while thinking about hierarchy. It's a story told well while thinking about labyrinthine, sometimes Byzantine, bureaucratic networks that aren't always rational.
Mm-hmm. Now, after a really interesting discussion of the Soviet case of computer chess, right? And I just want to mention that for listeners. Yeah. There's a really interesting discussion here toward the later part of Chapter 5 of computer chess, of Botvinnik's pioneer project, of the book database, if these are meaningful to chess fans or computer chess kind of aficionados. There's a really, really interesting discussion of that at the end of Chapter 5. But what I want to ask you to talk a little bit about is something that follows up from what you were just talking about, right? Which really nicely, I think, leads us into the conclusion. Now, the conclusion kind of wraps up some of the major lessons from the story that you've just been telling us in the book and that you've so nicely kind of summarized and introduced and translated for us here in this conversation. And it moves us outward into some kind of broader possible outcomes or broader possible ways that this is relevant for not just how we understand networking more broadly, but how we kind of inhabit the world and the networked world that we live in right now. So the conclusion brings the work of Hannah Arendt into the conversation, and it talks about some of what you suggest are some of the most important lessons of the Soviet case for today. One of the really interesting things that comes up here is your discussion of the notion of privacy. Right. This is something that I think a lot of listeners and readers might take for granted. Right. We think we know what privacy is. Right. It's the opposite of something being public. Right. It's private. Mm-hmm. Like, what's so complicated? Mm-hmm. But you're actually, I think, really usefully asking us to think much more critically about this notion as it animates the way we think about and, again, inhabit a networked world right now. So I would just really love to invite you at this point to talk a little bit about that. And if you are interested in sharing more broadly right now your thoughts of the implications beyond this rethinking of privacy, please feel absolutely welcome to do that as well.
Cool. Thanks. Right. So Arendt ends up helping me a lot because I felt at the end of the project that I had tried to deconstruct but was still stuck within a very binary Cold War system. And in particular, I was stuck thinking about Cold War networks as a state would see it. And that meant for me kind of rehearsing a basic liberal economic discourse, right? So that it seemed as if the polar, my coordinate system for analysis was still a tension between public states and private markets, between planned Soviet economies and entrepreneurial U.S. startups and the rest of it. And that just doesn't feel right for me. But Arendt, who's in the middle of it, writes, and I think beautifully allows us to pivot our coordinate of analysis away from state public states and private markets to a different sense of public-private, maybe almost perpendicular, where she sees in a classic Aristotelian distinction the public as the place where voices, political voices, can be sound and acted upon, and where, by contrast, the private is the oikos, the root Greek word, root for our word economy, and actually the word that means household. She sees in other books, not just in The Human Condition, but elsewhere, the 20th century is basically beset by different forms of increasingly powerful households. So whether you want to talk about markets or state, socialist states, or many other trivially, scalably large organizations, what we're dealing with is a private household that seeks its own selfish interests. And for her, this is a problem for lots of reasons. Marx, for example, gets it wrong by sort of pedestaling the wrong image of the human being. We don't want the basic worker for Arendt to be the high point of humanity, but rather the political speaker and the actor. Anyway, the point for me is that this pivot to think about private organizations and public as a place of political action allows us to rethink our own stakes in network conversations today, in particular privacy. So let me see how quickly I can say this. Habermas once pointed out that the English word publicity is lost on us, basically. We don't have a word for the public sphere, Öffentlichkeit in German, is best rendered as like publicness or something, a public sphere, because the word publicity, the essence of being public, has been bought out by PR agents and the advertising marketing regimes. It's been bought out by private households, effectively. And I wonder, in the conclusion, whether we might be facing the same situation with privacy, with the word privacy. That is to say, I think we tend to think of privacy today as sort of this private sense of the dignified self, or the ability to be left alone, Warner Brandeis's famous phrase, or rather the ability to disclose one's own personal information. And that's fine and useful and workable. But I wonder if instead the real privacy that we ought to be working about is the overarching saturation of power-oriented private organizations, whether the NSA or Google or the Microsoft cloud or what have you, that are, have been for the longest time, and not just since the rise of networks, interested in privatizing our information from us, being privy to, right, us, rather than us having the space to be political. And I think that pivot allows us to both rethink and move beyond the Cold War discourse that, again, I think we still have an uneasy allegiance to in how we describe networks, liberty, commerce, democracy, and the rest of it. And instead to really start thinking critically about what common, what sort of how the Soviet story hits home, that it's an allegory much closer than we may care to admit, that it too was beset by private organizations interested in using networks to privatize our information. And that seems like a takeaway that I want to hold on to. In the side view of Mir, the Soviet case study appears closer than we may be comfortable with.
So then, if you can believe it, we're actually at the conclusion of our conversation right now. This has gone so fast, and it's been so full of what I think are just really fascinating moments in the book. Now, of course, we can't be comprehensive in this medium, right? I mean, and hopefully listeners will have a chance to grab a copy of the book and read it themselves. But in the meantime, is there anything that we didn't have a chance to talk about, but that you'd like to mention for listeners?
I briefly want to thank you for your summary. I would much rather have you summarize my book than me. So like the major things have been done. I might point briefly to some really fun things that Glushkov and his friends are working on theoretically that didn't come to be, just natural language programming or macro piping processing that's modeled after the brain, or something even called mind uploading, or not mind uploading, they called it information immortality, even more broadly, more boldly, but a kind of a science fiction inspired attempt to theorize the uploading of collective and individual memories onto networks. So what we're facing is this old trope where the Soviet scientists are theoretically advanced, even though they're stumbling in practice or in application. But there's some really lovely ways that I think that theoretical richness reminds us of something that we need to bear in mind today, which is that astonishing genius and imaginative foresight and even political acumen are not enough to change the world. And that failure is not the word I want, but breakdown or rupture is normal. And that should be part of our historiography, should be part of our sense of invention and innovation, our sense of maybe social relationships too.
Great. And now that the book is out, and congratulations on what I hope is obvious that I think is a super fascinating book, what's next for you? What are you currently working on and inspired by?
Yeah, so I'm having great fun. I should mention selfishly that Princeton just went official with the launch of an edited volume called Digital Keywords that I put together with 25 friends on the 40th anniversary of Raymond Williams' classic Keywords. And so it's an update for the information age of words that I think, or that we think, do critical work. And so that's something that's just happened. And you can see more at Culture Digitally or at Princeton. But I would say the thing that keeps me up at night is, I don't know, I mean, how do I put this best? What if one of the accidental ideas to come from the 20th century is that the mind is the ideal processor, right? The ideal computer processor. And it's kind of like this hubristic sense of what the mind thinks about itself, that we have for the longest time through cybernetics or cognitive science or neuroscience or the rest of it kind of wrapped ourselves up in a mistaken sense of what computing and processing might really be about. And what I'd like to offer instead is a counter history of computing and new media since 1870, not 1970, that would tell us a different way of thinking about computing, where computing is about social practice and groups working together to solve problems, small seminal groups I'm calling thought labs, and not the kind of individual genius mind at work on their own. So I think that there's another bigger, I think, deeper stakes history that I'm trying to tell about the origins of the information age.
Well, best of luck with that, Ben, and thank you so much for taking time away from that work to talk with us today. It's really been a pleasure.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you, Carla.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks very, very much for joining me at the podcast, and I'll catch you next time.